You're listening to CITR News, your weekly look at Vancouver News Report, giving you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isa Yu.
I'm Arman Rana. It's Thursday, December 19th at 5:04 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamenam-speaking Musqueam people. We have a jam-packed show for you today. News Collective member Zachary Tharp interviewed Rory Mills, one of the coordinators of the regenerative cultural brands at Extinction Rebellion, UBC, to get the scoop about who they are and what they actually do. We then have a conversation we recorded in studio last night with Nandita Ratan, a student at Emily Carr, whose art has garnered attention on Instagram for its depiction of Indian politics. To finish off, we've got some fun headlines about City Hall and developments in transit and transportation here in Vancouver.
So usually the interviewer does the introductions, but seeing as our friend Zachary Tharp is off frolicking in California, I will be taking over and introducing this week's piece for Why We March. Last week, Zach teased his interview with Rory Wills from Extinction Rebellion UBC, and today we got the full conversation. Let's take a listen.
Hello, my name is Zachary Tharp, and I'm interviewing...
My name is Rory Mills. I'm currently one of the coordinators of the Regenerative Culture Branch at Extinction Rebellion UBC.
And can you tell me what Extinction Rebellion's about, and what do you guys stand for?
Yeah, absolutely. So Extinction Rebellion is a climate activism group. It is widespread across the world by now, but we at the UBC chapter have been working here for about 3 months. Extinction Rebellion is a general, more of a hardline climate activism group. We're taking a more serious approach to the current climate crisis.
And for anyone who's never like heard of Extinction Rebellion and the climate divestment, could you explain how what you guys stand for like play into that and what this divestment situation that's going on campus is about?
Yeah, absolutely. So many people might have seen that very recently UBC declared a climate emergency that was presented by Santa Ono at the most recent Board of Governors meeting. This climate emergency declaration is kind of in response to the divestment campaign that a lot of climate activism groups are on campus and the general trend of UBC has been running. So the divestment campaign is currently, so UBC has endowment pools, which they to gain in, additional income as a business as well as a university. And UBC has the second largest endowment of Canadian universities. And this endowment, UBC has a bit of control as to where this money goes to. And currently, a lot of that money is tied up in fossil fuel investments. And UBC is claimed to be worldwide as one of the, or as the best university when it comes to climate activism, climate action. So what we would like to see, and what a lot of groups on campus would like to see, is UBC divest these funds that are currently invested in the fossil fuel industry to sustainable energy, which is part of the campaign that has been continuing this past 4 or 5 years. XRUBC has only been involved for the past 3 months or so, but we've already had quite a significant impact on the conversation.
It's great. And so, like, the university declared a climate emergency last week in accordance with many other universities around the world and several foreign governments. In addition to this, the university has moved, about 22% of the funds of the endowment, about $380 million, to a fossil-free fund, and will explore options to move to a full divestment. However, the university said that this would take several months and, you know, it would take just all this time for consideration. What could the university do to speed up that process, if you would have any notes for them?
Yeah, so the university has been pretty famous at dragging its feet on some key issues. With the most recent Board of Governors meeting, there was a lot of talk about the way that the university wants to continue with this action, but not a lot of commitment. There was announced that there is going to be a... there is going to be a brand new kind of working group of an environmental committee that is going to be focusing on this, but that is only going to take place in about spring, and that is the exact details of that are yet as unconfirmed. In accounts to this, the legality and the specifics when it comes to divestment, yes, UBC did commit to 22% of the endowment fund, which has been a long time coming, and a lot of groups see that as a major win. But XRUBC would like to see UBC act in a manner as though the climate crisis is real. With the declaration of the climate emergency, we would like to see a mobilization of UBC's resources towards actually continuing this process. As of yet, a lot of promises have been made with a lot of empty words. And although the board seems to be trending towards the process of divestment, they are certainly going to be slowing down that process, or not going quite as expeditiously as we would like them to go. As well, so the Board of Governors, they need a legal opinion to continue the divestment talk, and as of yet, they have currently not committed to full divestment, which is a key notion of the campaign, that legal opinion is supposed to come back on February 6th in 2020, but in a crisis where every day counts, and we are in a time where, I mean, the figures speak for themselves, and I'm sure I could go into that if need be. But what we would really like to see is UBC use its vast amount of resources and expedite the process of divestment. And keyly, we're not looking for full divestment at the end of the year. We want a commitment to divestment, because currently UBC hasn't committed. They've laid out a framework, but they have the possibility of not continuing if the legal opinion comes back negative. So that is something that we would like to see, and something that we expect from the world's climate leader.
And this divestment, the commitment and its, you know, legal framework, if it comes back negative, would you try to seek other legal counsel, or is that just not even an option for you guys? Like, it's going to happen kind of thing?
So with the way the Board of Governors works, they will tend to make decisions and then find legal opinions that back up these decisions. So regardless, it is very likely that UBC is going to divest. It's just the time frame as to which that counts in a crisis where every day, every month, every minute matters. There can be no time for UBC to drag their feet. They've noted to us in several communications. We recently got reached out to by Michael Korenberg, the UBC Board of Governors chair, kind of detailing to us as to how over the break upcoming, the UBC kind of process as to what they can do is going to slow down, because many of their members are going to be going on break, but unfortunately the climate crisis isn't going to take a break either. So we would like to see UBC actually use their sufficient resources and their substantial ability to mobilize them to actually give this crisis the attention it deserves.
And when people think of Extinction Rebellion, you guys have, you know, chapters all around the world, and you're constantly in the news. And if, you know, and they're, you know, protesting their respective governments in ways, you know, such as shutting down traffic and bridges, or having, you know, full-blown funerals I've seen for the climate, do you think these protests are aimed at more aimed more at causing disruption more than anything, or do they call out a certain group or person? What is their overall I would say point, but what are they aimed for?
Yeah, so Extinction Rebellion as a whole is looking to mobilize the population of the world generally to about 3 or 4% of people openly rebelling or openly making it known that we are not standing by as our planet is destroyed. Essentially, our actions in terms of arrestability, shutting down bridges, that kind of thing, is meant to be both a kind of a direction towards getting more people involved, letting the movement be known, and letting the crisis be known as well. Because unfortunately, with the way that media works nowadays, you need to gain attention before you can even deliver the message. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't even know the severity of the crisis right now. They don't know that currently Canada isn't even on par to meeting the Paris Accords. In fact, if Canada continues business as usual, we might have the chance of reaching the 2050 target of carbon emissions by 2961. So that's about 1,000 years too late with our current estimates. And as much as the Canadian government would like to let Canada be seen as a climate leader, very similar to UBC being seen being seen as a climate leader across the world, our actions and what's actually going on the ground speaks a very different story. So that's kind of the attention that we're trying to draw towards.
And when you said like business as usual, you know, there's a lot of work, you know, everyday working Canadians out there and people around the world just, you know, trying to go from point A to point B working. Do you think that this might these protests where you're shutting down bridges and stopping traffic, do you think this might be causing you to lose support from these everyday working people who, you know, now can't get to work because of these protests? Do you think that might be alienating that kind of group that might be supportive, but now that they're not, you know, feeling as supportive?
Yeah, I think maybe it's a better way to frame this is to look at the impact that climate change is having across the globe. There are conservative estimates of climate change impacts say that about 300,000 people a year are dying from climate change. So we are lucky in countries like Canada to be able to see actions like Extinction Rebellion and being like, oh yes, that for one day of work that might prevent you from getting to work on time or something like that. But the amount of impact that's happening is very disproportional to a lot of the marginalized communities across the world. Things I'll keep it in Canada alone, but the impact that's happening across the world is devastating right now. For Canada specifically, we're getting worse forest fires. Vancouver reported 80% increase in the number of asthma prescriptions. British Columbia has about almost 2,000 species of animals and plants at risk of extinction. In as soon as 10 years, Richmond, Delta, and parts of Abbotsford and Coquitlam will be underwater. Or at least parts of them. So this is an impact that is happening across the world, and we're going to see the effects soon here in cities like Vancouver and Canada as a whole. But just because the impacts of climate change aren't happening here doesn't mean they're not happening across the world. And even though we might be disrupting people here, if we're drawing attention to the people that are actually dying from famine and from floods across the world due to climate change, then I think it's a worthwhile exchange.
And I know, you know, a lot of people have been hearing about the Extinction Rebellion here at UBC. And could explain the hunger strike that you guys have been talking about? And why is this going on? And why is this idea one that Extinction Rebellion felt had to be done?
Yeah, absolutely. There are several universities across North America and Great Britain that have committed to divestment, usually from pressure from climate groups, and a lot of them have used the hunger strike tactic before to draw attention to the issue. In terms of what we're asking, we're not even asking for full divestment. A term used at one of the Board of Governors meetings was low-hanging fruit, and this is our demands are even one of them. We, at the end of the year, we're not even looking for full divestment. We're just looking for commitment to divestment, and that is something that we believe the university is absolutely able to provide, and something that is not a very high demand. And even in our most recent communications with the Board of Governors. Their communication in the letter we received from Michael Kornberg, his statements made it seem as though we were asking for full divestment at the end of the year, and this just goes to show that either the Board of Governors isn't paying attention to us, or they don't think of the crisis as severely as we do, because our demands have been very explicitly published on all our social media. We've been printing our demands and delivering them by hand at a Board of Governors meetings. So in terms of the communication and the severity of what we think the crisis and what the world seems to think the crisis is at, we just don't think that the university is responding on the same level. And we'd like to see a mobilization of resources and an actual acting as though the truth is real, and acting as though the crisis is real.
Do you think that this hunger strike could be more detrimental to the students that participate in it, or is that just wanting, you guys just really feel so passionately that you need to do this? Or do you think that along the way there might be another alternative that you're willing to do?
Yeah, I mean, so when it comes to alternatives, there has been this campaign, this divestment campaign, has been going on at UBC for 4+ years now, and they've been presenting to the Board of Governors very concrete facts as to why the Board of Governors should choose to start the divestment movement, but it's something that hasn't gone through, and with Extinction Rebellion being a movement which is based in civil disobedience and really trying to bring attention to the issue through really severe actions, a hunger strike is really one of the ways that we can really catch the eye of both the media and the university to fulfill the demands that frankly aren't much of an ask. And when it comes to commitment from the students, Every student is acting out of their own accord. There's no absolute requirement to join the hunger strike, but of course it's open to anyone who would like to. But Extinction Rebellion, UBC, we have a general support structure ready to take care of the students, and of course they're going to be going through a hardship. I mean, not eating for however long it's going to take. I mean, that's something that food insecurity and crop instability is something that is becoming more widespread across the world, and with crop production is down about 10% already in accordance to the climate crisis. So there's a very big parallel between us not eating and and the rest of the world, in which a lot of marginalized communities are already experiencing starvations, famines, which are causing deaths. So in terms of the severity of the crisis, we think that even us putting our bodies on the line isn't in concordance with what is happening to a lot of people across the world. It's just something that we can do and use our privilege to make UBC listen.
Are you a BIPOC individual at UBC who's interested in journalism? Well, the UBC official student newspaper has a dedicated space for you. The UBC staff and UBC journalism students have launched the Canadian Journalists of Color UBC chapter Facebook group. We're also aiming to host meetings, speakers, and workshops in the near future. You can search for us on Facebook or give us a shout at coordinating@ubc.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview with Rory Wills, one of the coordinators of the Regenerative Culture Branch at Extinction Rebellion UBC by Zachary Tharp on the demands of the Extinction Rebellion in their hunger strike. Last night, Armand and I spoke to Nandita Khatan, an artist whose art on the political climate in India has garnered thousands of likes. Let's take a listen. Could you start by introducing yourself?
Hi, I'm Nandita. Mm-hmm. I'm a grad student at Emily Carr, and I've got a background in illustration, communication design, and all around just somebody who likes drawing and doing things that involve images and text.
So what's your preferred medium?
Right now, unfortunately, it's digital. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I definitely miss using watercolors and gouache. Gouache was so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a difference between the use of the different mediums for different purposes?
Yeah, I'd say yes, because I've noticed that when you do something that's digital, you can pretty much like mimic what a medium would look like. So that's kind of, as long as it needs to go up somewhere, go into print, or you have to make copies out of something, it's great when something's digital because it's easier to just work with. You just click on a brush and you keep going. And texture is not very difficult to manipulate. But on the other hand, if you say try to digitize something that's watercolors, most people, especially when you're beginning, you'll find like it's difficult to clean up your image. It's difficult to make sure that the clarity comes through. But if you say maybe watercolors versus acrylics are easier to clean up, easier to digitize over time and reproduce.
So you have a series of designs of matchboxes, and I see one from April the 23rd, which is a match box with two glasses of chai and the inscription Couples, India's number one wax matches. Could you talk a bit more about the significance of the matchbox and this design in particular?
So the matchbox project was basically a part of my graduate research, and I've been looking at items that are printed, things that are memorabilia, Indian packaging, Indian advertisements, sort of to just see how culture translates into things that are printed. And this particular one was interesting because in this series of matchboxes, I've been trying to say, okay, so I have this big collection of older printed things that are now considered memorabilia. How exactly do I kind of contemporize those things, have them still be relevant today using an aesthetic that is old? Because the aesthetic does still hold a lot of cultural value and significance. So for this one, I basically looked at the fact that when you're in the street on India, the first thing you do if you're outside with somebody and you don't have too much of an agenda, you're most likely to walk up to a little store and order two cups of tea. And it's the best way to pass time. And it's something that if you go, say, down, logically any particular place in any city, this is a full India-wide thing, you will find a lot of couples sitting by the sides of the roads drinking and sharing tea. And they'll spend hours there just doing that. So it's not necessary that you have to go to a place that serves tea in fancy location. You could just sit by the road and share tea. And hence couples.
I've scrolled through your Instagram and I've found like a shift from like a more apolitical, more personal or cultural kind of art towards something more political. Was that shift conscious?
Oh, the shift was definitely conscious because I've always been somebody who's been interested in politics and things that are political. Everything's political. But things that are out there and political and happening. But I've tried to steer away from making art about it because I know that, one, I'm going to have to keep up to date with everything all the time, and it's a massive burden to bear. And I didn't think I was ready for that. But now, considering the state of events in India and being this far away from home, I felt like this was the only way I was going to be able to make a difference. There's no way that I can actually fly back home and be a part of a protest. So this is my way of saying things matter, it's time to wake up, and everybody needs to do something regardless of how small their contribution.
What do you think is the role of an artist in, like, the political landscape? Is there a place for artists?
There's definitely a place, because without an artist, you're not going to have political satire. You're not going to have a way of making text and things that are being said and things that are being passed or things that are happening kind of surpass this language barrier and the fact that things are sometimes not as accessible when they're in words because they come across as complicated and difficult to disseminate. But when you have an artist, there is an image that comes into question. And an image, especially in a country like India, means so much more than words because we've got a gazillion languages. And for something to get translated across all of that and for it to be in text is going to be really difficult. So the arts definitely play a large, large role.
Yeah, so you're recently you had this design that you posted on Instagram with the inscription, "India is burning," which went viral with over 10,000 likes.
Mm-hmm.
For our listeners, the design depicts the map of India with fires at a lot of the major cities, the biggest fires being in the states of Assam and Jammu and Kashmir, as well as the capital, Delhi.
Mm-hmm.
The subtitle is, "Don't Look the Other Way." Why do you think that the design resonated with so many people and did the opposite of resonate with so many other people?
Well, for one, I think it worked because of the fact that it's pretty clear. I'm not really giving you any information that's new as such. Everything on that image is already being portrayed to some extent by the media. But when you hear it, it comes off as, this is just news. But when you see it in an image and you see it at the magnitude of actual fire representing a protest and the fact that it's not an image with too much detail. It's just fire, line work, and a little bit of text. And it doesn't really need to be in different languages, considering most of the words that are being used are very, very basic English as well. So I think the fact that it just kind of conveyed one point very clearly is what worked. And the part that didn't work was clearly the fact that, one, a lot of these protests are changing and the news is coming in really fast, so the information is changing, and obviously this poster is going to be inconsistent given time. And two, because there are a lot of people who are against what is happening in the country. They don't like that people are protesting it, but that's also because there's a lot of misinformation about what's happening in India right now.
There's one thing interesting I noticed about that design is that the fire on Jammu and Kashmir obscures the border between Jammu and Kashmir and Pakistan, and that's a disputed border. Was that intentional?
It was intentional. One, because there's this, I know when I'm making an image, you try to be as accurate about things as possible. You have to do your research beforehand. And I know with this particular subject, that map in itself has been contested. Those lines have been contested. Like, the number of times we've heard that the maps that we're actually seeing of India are no longer what an Indian map looks like. And I didn't want to have to put out an image that was not going to correspond with what things actually are like.
There's also the exhortation, don't look the other way. Who is this? Who's the audience for this statement? Is it for, like, an Indian person such as ourselves sitting abroad in Vancouver in a relatively stable place? Is it for people in India?
Well, it's definitely for us. It's also definitely for people who have the privilege to look the other way in India because the things that are happening are going to affect minorities across India. And it's very easy for us to forget that just because we have the privilege to exclude ourselves from the narrative that's happening, that does not mean that we should and does not mean that it's okay to do so. It's don't look the other way is literally to say it's time you get off your butt and do something about it.
So another political design you have is, you know, has on a red background has people of various faiths and genders with their arms raised, and the statement is India against the CAB and NRC, stand with Kashmir and Assam. What are the NRC and CAB, and why are different communities against it?
Right now, what's happening is there's this thing called the CAB or the CAA, which is the Citizenship Amendment Act. And this was passed on the 11th of December, and the act exists, it's been amended in the past, but it's what's being amended right now that is incredibly unconstitutional, goes against the fact that India is a secular republic. And it is, it basically aims to give citizenship to refugees and persecuted minorities in Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. But what it fails to do is address the fact that it's not applicable to Muslim minorities from any of these places. And it disregards the Rohingyas from Myanmar, the Elam Tamils from Sri Lanka, the Ahmadiyyas from Pakistan, and the Muslim minorities in China. So the thing is, it's great, I guess, to some extent that the CAB is trying to say that they're going to give immigrants from these different places citizenship or refuge. But what we are and what the government is failing to make clear is its association with something called the NRC. Now, the NRC is the National Register of Citizens, also something that has existed in the past. But now paired up with CAA, what it does is it asks all Indian citizens to prove their Indianness and their them being citizens of India through their ancestry. So what that means is they're not asking for something like your Aadhaar card or your PAN, which would be the equivalent to maybe BCID over here. Instead, it's literally trying to say that if you have parents or grandparents who've come to India after a certain cutoff date, you need to prove not only that they came there within that cutoff date, but also that you're their children. And that's incredibly problematic because India being a country that is not just of different religions, we also have different castes. And having all of these sections that divide us as people, and whilst being in such a large country that has faced a partition, it makes it incredibly difficult for a lot of people who are minorities to furnish these documents, especially if you look at something, a situation wherein after the partition, we've had Muslim families that have come into India, and a large number of them might still be economically unstable. And at a point in time like that, when you have people moving across the border, even though it was so many years ago, what happens is a lot of these documents are not something that you prioritize. You're carrying your life on your back across a large portion of land and trying to find a place you can call home. So a lot of these things don't get solved even after generations because a lot of times you don't know where you've come from.
So could you explain also, because Assam has, you know, somewhat different concerns, which is a region in northeast India. So could you explain a little bit about why their concerns are somewhat different than the concerns that you outlined right now with this, with both the NRC and CAB?
So what's happening is if you take Assam, which is a state in the northeast, it's a part of what we like to call the Seven Sisters. It's a large group of northeastern states that are pretty much, they have smaller communities, a lot of tribes and a lot of tribal land. Their languages are technically susceptible to being taken over if there is an influx of immigrants and it doesn't get curbed to some extent, because in Assam is the gateway into India for Bangladeshi immigrants. And while the rest of India might not
also,
mind...
Sorry to interrupt you, also from the Rohingya Muslims from...
Exactly, Burma. Exactly. And the Rohingya Muslims from Burma, what tends to happen is instead of a lot of these immigrants trickling into the rest of India, they tend to settle down in Assam, which would be all right if Assam had the resources and the numbers to even that balance out. But if the immigrants do settle down over there, what will happen eventually is that the Assamese will become a minority in their own state. They're going to have to contest for the same jobs. There's going to be that much more strife for a really small population of people that are already going through so much and trying to preserve their rights. And because this is not the first time Assam has had to fight for this.
And their sovereignty.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's kind of comparable. It's, of course, very different, but it's in some ways more comparable to questions of indigenous sovereignty here in Canada for our audience. And yeah.
So last question, you mentioned prior to this interview that you received a lot of aggressive comments on your most recent Instagram posts. How do you think artists should deal with these issues as they move to social media platforms?
It's definitely something that I'm still trying to figure out because I have a really small following, at least I had a really small following. Now, what happened once this particular image took off is that I had a flood of love from different places all over the world, in fact. But I also had over 400 really hateful comments that were not just in my comment section, but they reached my inbox as well, and there'd be people saying a lot of terrible things. And as somebody who has such a small following and such a small circle of artists around me, I kind of feel like after a certain point of time, I had to block my comment section off because there was no curbing it. But I think with time and practice, and once you have a community of people backing you, there are definitely ways in which you can moderate your comment section. Use the place instead for productive conversation about this whole thing, because as maybe the face of my own one-person organization, it's going to be really difficult to elicit meaningful conversations there. But if you have more than one person trying to, I guess, pitch in or moderate or find a way to turn things around or even maybe just try to find a way to incite some form of a dialogue over just hate speech, it would be fantastic, and that's definitely something that I want to be looking at. And I think others in my position might also.
Now that we've had this conversation, is there anything that you would like to add that you feel is missing in this conversation about both in terms of your experience with these putting these artworks out there through Instagram, but also in terms of what's happening in India?
In terms of the artwork and what's happening in India, the one thing that I really would like to say is, again, if you happen to be Indian or if you happen to also not be Indian but you care greatly for something happening on the other side of the world, please, please contribute. Try to figure out what is going on. Social media is full of information because we need support not just in terms of an interview like this or maybe 50 others, but we need like multiple people talking about this and doing something about this because pressure from within the country is growing, but it'd be great if we had support from the outside.
And you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Welcome back. The interview you just heard was with Nandita Ratan. Forgive me for any mispronunciations. And she was talking about her art and the role of art more broadly in politics. So we hope you enjoyed that. We're not going to go on to some local headlines. We switch things up a bit.
Yeah, it's a headlines or tail lines.
Tail lines.
Because they come at the end. I don't know. So we're changing a lot of things. I don't know if we're still called Democracy Watch anymore.
Yeah.
Like, are we CITR News? Are we Vancouver this weekend?
If y'all have any ideas, tweet at us, you know.
Yeah.
Get that engagement.
Yeah. So headlines, tail lines. So after a lot of discussion of an 8.3 property tax increase, Council ended up approving a budget with a 7% increase. Last week, we spoke to Alex Hemingway of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives about the increase last week.
one thing that struck me about the budget discussion was how it really, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, parties don't matter anymore, everybody's voting, whatever. And
on the local level.
At the local level, because we saw this last year, there were a lot of different, like, votes where it was just, like, Gene Swanson and Colleen Hardwick voting against something and everyone else voting for it. Or, like, you know, Pete Fry and, I don't know, Kirby Young voting for something and nobody else voting for it. And yeah. It's just, like, different factions that don't follow strictly, like, conventional ideological lines. But we see with this budget that, you know, these kind of affiliations still matter because, you know, the NPA voted as a bloc against it, and the former NPA counselor, Rebecca mm-hmm. Bly, also voted against it, and everybody else voted for it. And so you can see that kind of fiscally conservative strain in the NPA and in their former counselor, Rebecca Bly, still coming through. So I think that was the most interesting thing to kind of take away from it. What did you think, Alex?
What did I think? Well, I haven't really prepared in-depth thoughts, but as you say, I usually have an opinion. I was looking a bit through the press release the city sent out this morning that detailed the budget that passed and sort of what they kept in and what they reduced. As you said, you know, it went from proposed 8.3 to 7. So they actually didn't cut that much. I thought that they'd go down to a bit lower, but I was wrong.
That looks quite surprising. Like, I'm surprised, yeah. Especially like Councillor Weeb. I thought he would have like wanted a bit lower.
And like you said, I do think he was probably the deciding factor on this vote because, yeah, as we know now, his parents own a lot of properties in the city.
Oh, really?
So just so everyone knows that, I'm sure it doesn't bias his opinion at all.
Well, clearly not.
Well, this is the most, yeah, that's surprising to me. But so the things that they did cut, some of the things they cut were they cut they went from 7.95 million to 6.1 million on projects that protect and build the economy. So those are social policy initiatives and some environmental initiatives. So they cut a little bit from the Vancouver plan, which is the citywide plan, funding that was going into that, as well as a couple like social issues, programs to develop or promote diversity, enhance diversity in our city. That's not really that surprising. Like, and they didn't cut that much. Like they still, it's not like they slashed like a program, diversity initiative, or
they just reduced the funding for
it. Yeah, they just reduced the funding.
They also jacked up like the parking fees or something.
Yeah, yeah. So they had some small measures to compensate for this higher property tax. Obviously, nothing that is going to make a real dent. But it was interesting to see that in terms of these kind of like these issues that they cut from that had to do with that were social, economic, issues in our city, the things that they didn't take a cent away from were housing issues, like funding that was going towards developing housing property and research to deal with the housing crisis, and also stuff to deal with climate change
and policing.
Well, yeah, I was gonna get to that, but right. that's like a separate category, yeah. I think. So like Those are the two priorities of council, and that makes sense. And we've seen that in the motions they've passed. Yeah, and then, you know, the whole other section, like what percent of our budget goes to police? It's huge. What is it, like 40% or something? It's really big. Don't quote me on that, but it's a very large percent of our budget. I think it's the biggest chunk of the budget. They didn't cut anything from the firefighters and the police. And I think they added, what was it, like 36 new firefighters or something? I'm going to look up.
There was a motion to cut police funding, I believe, or not add some 35 or 25 new officers.
Was it Gene who tabled that?
Yeah, of course. And I think only Gene and Christine Boyle voted for that. And there's a lot of discussion with, I think, Councillor Melissa DeGenova,
yeah,
about her conflict, perceived conflict of interest with her spouse being a
VPD or something?
Yeah, both her and Sarah Kirby Young are married to police officers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess Counselor DeGenova was recusing herself a bunch, and then Sarah Kirby Young wasn't, and it was like, why one and not the other? I'm trying to figure out how much of the budget goes to police. Anyway, it's a lot. But, yeah, other takeaways from the budget, off the top of my head, some people are really mad. George Affleck, former counselor, has been on Twitter pretty mad about this. Basically, the counselors and the mayor who voted in favor of the budget said, like, there hadn't been upgrades to certain core programming in a while. And so this hike in property tax was kind of owing to what had been put off by Vision, the former council. And so that's in part why it seems so much higher. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think also we can see in this budget that a lot of these councillors who voted for all these measures throughout the year, like especially in the NPA, I find it interesting that they're surprised by this level of the property tax hike.
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing for, I think, us to be surprised. But if you're a counselor, I thought you would be closely following and, you know, every time you approve a big spending measure or kind of indicate to staff that this is where we want to allocate new resources, you would be kind of interacting with them some way to get an idea of what the budget would be, what the implication would be for the budget. Mm-hmm. So I find it interesting. I think it goes to show in some ways that we have a very new council that hasn't had a lot of experience in council before, and I guess this won't happen. And it also maybe got to do with staff. Maybe they miscommunicated in some way.
But also, you're saying this council has been around for a year. They've tabled a lot of motions, passed a lot of motions, and passing motions requires work and research, and that costs money. And that's why the budget, in part, that's why the budget is so big. But at the same time, we would have to do a closer analysis on who was voting in favor of motions, because there are councillors who voted against a lot of motions,
like Hardwick.
So we'd have to look at that more closely. Certainly there are certain motions, broader priorities that have been more unanimous, and I'd say climate change is one of those. So, it would be interesting to look at what amount of the budget is going specific towards dealing with climate change and readying the city for that, and whether in the end NPA councillors who voted for that didn't really want to pay for it.
Yeah.
Be interesting to see. I don't know. It's interesting how much higher it is. The budget that passed in Vancouver is to Surrey, our neighboring city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a 7% increase. And they had like a 2% increase in Surrey.
2 point something, I think. Yeah.
There were some interesting developments in Surrey. I didn't quite follow, but there was a snafu there.
Yeah, there's been some snafus in Surrey, but I don't know enough to get into details.
Yeah, so.
Anyway, shall we move on?
To the next headline.
So ShareNow, formerly known as Car2Go, is pulling out of North America. And the company explained the decision was due to the volatile state of the mobility industry and rising costs to sustain operations in the North America. So Vancouver members of the car sharing service will have until February 29th to use up their credits. Have either of you used Car2Go or similar car sharing services?
I have not, but I've been in them when other people have driven me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And would you say they play how strong of a presence do you feel that these ride sharing apps or services have in Vancouver?
I think they're now an important part of the way people get around. I think a lot of people use them. I think they're really great. They're a great way to reduce cars, because you don't really need a car in the city. I think they are kind of expensive. I've avoided getting an account because I'm afraid I'll use it, instead of taking the bus. That's my main fear.
I think one thing that's interesting about it is I remember reading somewhere that this is like one of the biggest markets for car sharing in North America. And one of the reasons they are kind of, you know, pulling out is because of the prevalence of the, what's it called, the ride sharing, ride hailing app.
Right. And, yeah, good point.
I believe that they're going to phase out, like, as you said, February 29th. And I believe by that point, there will be a lot more ride hailing in the city. And I believe they view ride hailing as a direct competitor to their product. And so I think it could potentially have a big impact on a lot of people. And I would imagine that a lot of those people would switch over to making more use of ride hailing.
Yeah, they must have done, like, crunched the numbers and been like, yeah. Because, again, like I said, it's not really cheap to use Car2Go or Evo. And I wonder how that would compare with taking a Lyft or Uber or Whistle or whatever that is. Because if that's cheaper than taxiing, it might be, yeah. And then that's obviously easier than you don't have to drive yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't have to go look for a Car2Go.
Exactly. Or park it, right? Yeah.
The Lyft just comes and picks you up from wherever.
Yeah, I'd rather do that.
Right. So on the topic of Lyft and Uber, ads for these companies have been popping up all around Vancouver. I don't know if you guys have noticed.
Yeah.
And the Passenger Transportation Board gave their first green light. I'm really funny. Thanks.
more like a yellow light, right?
Yeah, good. I agree with Armand.
Oh, ouch. Okay, so to a rideshare service, the Green Coast Ventures, Inc., a Tofino-based company operating under the name Whistle. And so they have gotten their license approved. And you guys were talking about how, like, you know, their competition to Car2Go and other companies like that. Yeah. The license is the first step. So we don't really know how long it's going to take for them to actually implement this. And Whistle is specific to places outside of the Lower Mainland. So like Tofino, Whistler, these resort areas. So we don't really know when we're going to have these ride hailing apps here
in Vancouver. Yeah.
Yeah. So would you like... What are your guys' stance? Would you guys be using those?
Well, first of all, I think, the issue is that with the different municipalities in the Lower Mainland, they all set their own registration fees, right, to be a driver.
Yeah. And one thing is that, Vancouver is different from other places where they already have these ride-hailing apps in that... I think we require you to have like a class 4 license.
Yeah. So we have totally. Yeah.
BC.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. BC. BC
requires that. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Different than the states. It may be different by state, but yeah. We've made it harder to become a driver. What do I think of it? I am not sure. I think cabs are too expensive. I think, you know, if cab companies were paying their drivers more and their CEOs less, then I would be more supportive, you know, of the prices. So, I mean, let's be real. Like, people are going to use them when they're here. People are going to use this service. Like, do you think people would actually be like, I'm not going to use it because I am supporting the cab drivers? Like, no.
I especially in non-Vancouver, I don't know.
Things are already so expensive.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, rightly or wrongly, there's a lot of resentment in Vancouver, I see, especially amongst young people, towards the cab industry in that.
Because it's really expensive.
Yeah.
Or why do you think that is? Like, do you think there are other reasons?
I think it's also because they feel that they kept out these ride-hailing apps for so long. Like, I think these ride-hailing apps are problematic, and you see some issues with them and a variety of issues in terms of like worker rights, in terms of also like causing traffic, excessive traffic, because like everybody rushes in one direction. So you have like a lot of empty cars causing traffic just to pick people up. And we see this a lot in San Francisco.
And also safety and like legislation around that.
Yeah.
Because you get a lot of people who have been, you know, where there's like really no retribution. Like, there's no...
You're saying safety for the driver?
Yeah, no, safety for the passengers. Passenger.
Right.
So, like, that's a concern for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, I think Lyft has had some issues with that.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of issues of safety for the drivers as well, because, like, the customers, because they provide the ratings, they can they can force the drivers to, like, make risky driving decisions. Like, I need to be there in, like, 10 minutes, otherwise I'll give you, like, a 3-star or a 1-star.
Oh, right? That's not good, yeah.
And they kind of they can kind of encourage the driver to make poor driving decisions. And I saw this one video where this drunk customer was, like, on a highway, and it was raining and it was dark, and he was, like, falling on top of the driver and, like, messing around with the steering wheel. And, yeah, so I think there are...
Yeah, that's really bad.
So that there's safety concerns, as you mentioned. I think on both sides.
Like anything, probably somewhere in between is like where things should be. Like, yeah, I mean, you can't have any system based entirely on customer feedback, because the customer is not always right. Yeah. Customer is, in fact, mostly wrong. Yeah.
So that's it for this week's show.
Yeah, what time is it?
It is 5:59, so we're
for the first time back.
Yeah. Time flies when you're having fun. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. If you are listening, if anyone's listening, we won't be playing anything. So Democracy Watcher news, CITR news, will not be happening next
Thursday.
Next Thursday. But
we might do a fill-in show at some point. But do check us out on our Facebook page, where we actually streamed today's show. So if you missed something out, you can probably watch the whole show again on the Facebook page.
I'm sure. Yeah. Armand and Tanner are the heroes of the hour for doing that. And also, we should say happy holidays to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Happy non-specified holidays.
We also have a YouTube account, so like, comment, and subscribe when we do have our episode out. All right, thank you, and
stay tuned for more CITR programming.
Bye. Okay.